Chapter 12. The Constitutional Case. The Constitutional Convention of 1787 was supposed to be limited in scope. The mandate from the states was to amend the Articles of Confederation. Need for free market among the states and a sound national currency was high on the agenda. Although there was no admission by some, the original goal was to discard the Articles of Confederation and write an entirely new constitution. The Federalist wanted a more centralized and powerful government, complaining that Congress lacked power to regulate domestic affairs and to collect taxes for national purposes. The Anti-Federalists, such as Patrick Henry, worried of the danger of eroding liberty if a centralized government were approved. Once the delegates were in Philadelphia, plans for changes other than interstate commerce and the national currency quickly emerged. Those who were concerned about the loss of liberty were given the Bill of Rights for additional protection against the encroachment of the federal government on the states. If the original intent of the Constitution had been followed, we wouldn't be where we are today. The protection against centralized government failed because of too many loopholes in the Constitution. But more so, over the years, we've had too many people in and out of government demanding that government should guarantee security rather than liberty. The authors of the Constitution were very much aware of the dangers of inflation and the need for commodity money. Destruction of the Continental dollar was vivid in their minds. The journals of the Continental Congress noted that paper currency is multiplied beyond the rules of good policy. No truth being more evident than that where the quantity of money exceeds what is useful as a medium of commerce, its comparative value must be proportionately reduced. Further, inflations tend to the depravity of morals and the decay of public virtue, a precarious supply for the war, debasement of the public faith, injustice to individuals, and the destruction of the honor, safety, and independence of the United States. The Constitution is clear about no paper money. Only gold and silver were to be legal tender. Since the states caused themselves harm when they issue their own paper money, the states were prohibited as well from issuing paper currency under the Constitution, Article 1, Section 10. No state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. So there you have it, plain and simple. Paper money is unconstitutional, period. The Constitution is silent on the issue of a central bank. But for anyone who cares about its intent, the Tenth Amendment is quite clear. If a power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, it doesn't exist. There is no mention whatsoever of a central bank being authorized. Even if a central bank were permissible, it could not legally repeal the legal tender mandate for gold and silver coins. A central bank, theoretically, could exist with a gold standard, but a gold standard doesn't need a central bank to manage it. Without this need, the motivation for having a central bank has to be questioned. It's not difficult to come to the conclusion that the purpose of a central bank, when a gold standard exists, is to get rid of it. During the convention, the issue of emitting bills of credit, i.e., convertible paper money, was fully debated and defeated. Neither the U.S. government nor the states would be permitted to issue paper money, and only gold and silver would be legal tender. Because of the runaway inflation of the Continental dollar of the 1780s and the founders' disdain for paper, no paper money was officially issued by the U.S. government until the Civil War. The prohibition of paper money was for convertible certificates. Even this was too great a temptation to be placed in the hands of government. Fiat money was such an outlandish idea that the founders didn't discuss it. What would they think of our creating trillions of dollars out of thin air and not even bothering to print the money? Today it's all done by computers without the slightest hint of oversight by the Congress. The argument over a central bank started early on. The Federalists supported it, and the Anti-Federalists opposed it. It was another instance of a Hamilton versus Jefferson argument. Hamilton won the argument early on, and the first Bank of the United States was established in 1791. It was left to expire in 1811 by Jefferson, who was a champion of hard money. The War of 1812, with its high debts and extravagant spending, caused financial problems and deficits bad enough that we again face the choice between centralization and liquidation. The choice for politicians is an easy one: short-term fix over long-term health. Madison, in 1816, created the Second of the United States. The constitutional argument over this bank in 1819 was of great significance. The seminal decision in favor of central banking in McCulloch v. Maryland not only was a major setback for sound money, the rationale by the Supreme Court for its decision did irreparable harm to the Constitution. One side argued, as Jefferson did, that the Constitution gave no specific authority to Congress to establish a central bank. The other side, the majority in the case, amazingly claimed that Congress had all the powers it wanted, except for those specifically denied by the Constitution. The whole idea of Article 1, Section 8, and the 10th Amendment was totally ignored. If they are correct in this interpretation, there would have been no purpose whatsoever in putting these provisions in the Constitution. It was agreed that the necessary and proper clause of Article 1, Section 8, permitted any law the current Congress thought necessary and proper. The fact that the necessary and proper clause was for exercising enumerated powers, only those powers explicitly granted by the Constitution, and in this case, those found in Article 1, Section 8, was ignored. This gross distortion and undermining of the Constitution by McCulloch v. Maryland has done great harm throughout our history and explains how we've ended up with the size of government we have today. It not only opened wide the doors for the Second Bank of the United States, it set the legal stage for the establishment of the Federal Reserve in 1913. Thus, the Supreme Court established the principle of implied powers, a completely subjective notion. No longer would there be much chance of paying heed to Jefferson's admonition, "Let no more be heard of confidence in man, but bind him down for mischief by the chains of the Constitution." In reality, the Constitution itself is incapable of achieving what we would like in limiting government power, no matter how well written. The morality of the people and the character and wisdom of our elected officials are the only things that count. Nevertheless, even with these limitations, we must do our best to bind them down from mischief with the rule of law, lest the chains be used to bind down those of us who oppose the wicked use of government power. The principle of implied powers, so clearly established in 1819, opened Pandora's box and unleashed the steady erosion of our liberties. This has been especially true in the past century. We lost twice on McCulloch v. Maryland and continue to suffer from both losses. This ruling set the stage for the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 and redefined the idea of necessary and proper. The Supreme Court has never been a friend of sound money and has rarely been a protector of the Constitution. The Supreme Court supported making greenbacks legal tender during the Civil War period using the same arguments as Marshall did in McCulloch v. Maryland. The courts have almost always defined legal tender as whatever Congress wanted, never adhering to the Constitution's clear mandate that only gold and silver coin be used as legal tender, and recognizing the prohibition against the emitting of bills of credit. I am doubtful the courts will ever be helpful to us in restoring constitutional money and ridding ourselves of the Federal Reserve System. In the case of Hepburn v. Griswold in 1869, the Supreme Court ruled wisely and found the legal tender laws unconstitutional. It has not been maintained in argument, nor indeed would anyone, however slightly conversant with constitutional law, think of maintaining that there is in the Constitution any express grant of legislative power to make any description of credit currency a legal tender in payment of debts, the court ruled. An act making mere promise to pay dollars a legal tender in payment of debts previously contracted is not a means appropriate, plainly adapted, really calculated to carry into effect any express power vested in Congress, that such an act is inconsistent with the spirit of the Constitution and that it is prohibited by the Constitution. But this ruling would not be allowed to stand, and 1 year later was reversed by another Supreme Court ruling in Knox v. Lee, 1870, in which the majority wrote, with evident disregard for the actual Constitution, "It would be sad, indeed, if this great nation were now to be deprived of a power so necessary to enable it to protect its own existence." But here William Graham Summer is exactly right. The legal tender decision did as great a wrong as the Dred Scott decision, and the latter instance shows us that it is not useful to discuss a constitutional question even after the court decided it. It will not probably take a war to overthrow the principle of the Legal Tender Act, but it may take a national bankruptcy. The Supreme Court was every bit as destructive in dealing with the confiscation of gold in 1933 and in the support it gave for the cancellation of all gold contracts. The government and the private issuers of gold bonds were not required to pay in gold. The idea of the government following contracts and enforcing contracts was buried, especially when it comes to money. The lack of respect for the Constitution, even in the 19th century, set the stage for the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Fear, misinformation, and ignorance allowed government to ram bad policies down the throats of the American people. This is not unlike giving the president authority to go to war and to bail out those least deserving help in an economic crisis. The rationalization that the state's interest supersedes the interests and the rights of the people is embedded in the arguments as to why the American people had to go along with those who hate commodity money and love central banking. The Fed was established as a result of the public and banking clamor for an elastic currency, and an elastic currency is nothing more than one that can be arbitrarily increased in volume at the discretion of the monetary managers. Sometimes they argue over who exactly will have the authority to do so, central bank or Congress or private banks themselves. Increasing the supply of money and credit is the proper definition of inflation, meaning that when the demands were heard for an elastic currency, all they were looking for was a legal right to inflate the currency for the benefit of whatever special interest they were concerned for at the moment. Noble intentions are always used to justify the inflation, but the real reasons are far more sinister. Those who get the control over the money are the beneficiaries, not the people as a whole. Economist John Maynard Keynes, before he became the champion of inflation, wrote quite correctly of the grave danger of inflation. Like Greenspan, he changed his tune as the years moved on. Keynes stated in his book, The Economic Consequences of the Peace, "Lenin is said to have declared that the best way to destroy the capitalist system was to debauch the currency. By a continuing process of inflation, governments can confiscate, secretly and unobserved, an important part of the wealth of their citizens. There is no subtler, no surer means of overturning the existing basis of society than to debauch the currency. The process engages all the hidden forces of economic law on the side of destruction, and does it in a manner which not one man in a million is able to diagnose." His Tract or Monetary Reform from 1923 is also clear. A government can live for a long time by printing paper money. That is to say, it can by this means secure the command over real resources, resources just as real as those obtained by taxation. A government can live by this means when it can live by no other. It is the form of taxation which the public finds hardest to evade, and even the weakest government can enforce when it can enforce nothing else. Marx's fifth plank of the Communist Manifesto mandates a strong central bank monopoly. This was seen as necessary to maintain power over the entire economy and to protect against the encroachment of capitalism. The Federal Reserve Act of 1913 established the Federal Reserve System to supervise the now fully elastic and easily debauched currency by the unconstitutional powers given to it. Not only would the Fed be able to create money out of thin air, banks were participating and benefiting in the process through fractional reserve banking. Unfortunately, but deliberately, a wall was built between the Federal Reserve and Congress. Congress created the system and could end it. Some say that the great evil is that it's a private bank. Therein lies the problem. If that were the only problem, all that would have to be done is to apply the laws against the Fed that apply to all other private corporations. I see the Fed as being much better off than just being private. It's sanctioned by the government, protected by the government, and has the privilege of total secrecy. The Fed's reports to Congress and hearings are for public consumption. Real information is not available to the public or to Congress, the Financial Services Committee, the Domestic Monetary Policy Subcommittee, or to me as a member of all three. I would never be permitted to attend Federal Open Market Committee hearings where all the big decisions are made. That's totally off limits. Their secrecy privilege is protected by law. If the creature can come into being without constitutional authority, it can escape all oversight that other government agencies must submit to. Even the CIA has more responsibility to report to a select few in Congress on its activity, although we can be certain that Congress remains in the dark there as well. The Government Accounting Office has the responsibility of auditing all government agencies. Title 31, Chapter 7 of the Money and Finance section of the Code describes its duties and powers to audit all financial institutions, including the Federal Reserve Board, Federal Reserve Banks, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and the Office of Comptroller of the Currency. That sounds pretty inclusive and clear, but there's a proviso in the law. It goes on to say, audits of Federal Reserve Board and Federal Reserve Banks may not include transactions for or with a foreign central bank, government of a foreign country, or non-private international financing organization. Deliberations, decisions, or actions on monetary matters, including discount window operations, reserves of member banks, securities credit, interest on deposits, and open market operations. Transactions made under the direction of the Federal Open Market Committee or a part of a discussion or communication among or between members of the Board of Governors and officers and employees of the Federal Reserve System related to clauses 1 through 3 of this subsection. So when Bernanke quickly refuses to give us information about the trillions of dollars of credit that he recently passed out in the bailout process because that would be counterproductive, he is really saying, it's none of your business. He may well be protected by the law, but he is in defiance of the Constitution. The courts, under today's circumstances, will never rule that the Federal Reserve Board chairman must reveal the information that the Congress or the people seek. The cries in Washington for more transparency of the whole mess are getting louder every day. The people are sick and tired of seeing hundreds of billions of dollars, i.e., the TARP funds, given to the Secretary of the Treasury without Congress knowing how the money will be spent. For many decades, several members of Congress, among them Louis McFadden, Wright Patman, and Henry Gonzalez, have demanded the books at the Fed be opened to inspection by the Congress through an audit by the GAO. Though some concessions have been made, such as the release of minutes 6 weeks after a FOMC meeting and reporting on some accounting statistics, the core of the Federal Reserve's transactions has remained hidden from congressional scrutiny. One thing I have noticed in studying the issue is that the more power the Fed has gained, the greater the secrecy they demand. Even today, no reports come from the Fed about providing a rather simple monetary aggregate like the M3 money supply. This is just a matter of counting the amount of money they print, which can be measured in many different ways. The silly reason the Fed gives for this is that they are saving money. Saving money by not counting it? Just maybe they think nobody will notice how much money they are creating by refusing to report it. Today, with the Fed dealing secretly with trillions of dollars worth of loans and guarantees and massively increasing their balance sheet, we are told practically nothing about the deals made with other central banks. Which countries and which currencies are bailed out, or which friends in the business and banking community are treated more fairly than the rest? Transparency is currently a hot issue in Congress because the people have awoken and have sent a message. That's what the spontaneous tea parties organized around the country are all about. This is not a conservative or liberal issue. It's not a Republican or Democratic issue. It is pervasive across the political spectrum. Progressive socialist and friend Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont introduced a bill to audit the Fed, and I introduced his bill in the House. I'm convinced that if we had an up or down vote on this bill in the House, very few would vote against it. That is a reflection of the concerns the American people hold and how the members of Congress are starting to get the message. Although it may appear that Congress ignores the people, when the people speak loudly and clearly enough, the political animals in Washington respond. Ever since the establishment of the Federal Reserve in 1913, there have always been at least a few congressmen fighting to expose the Fed for the mischief they cause. Generally, the argument against the Federal Reserve audit has been that certain elements deserve privacy, and also that there is no need for the people to know that much about the Federal Reserve. Before 1978, there was no explicit auditing authority for the GAO to examine the books at the Federal Reserve, and that was used as an excuse for no auditing being done. When a request came to Congress and legislation was finally written in 1978 giving the GAO authority to audit the Fed, the auditing authority was strictly limited, and all the important issues were explicitly excluded from the auditing process. The Fed will deny it, but because it wields so much power by controlling the money supply and interest rates, they have every reason in the world to maintain secrecy in all their activities. This has been known from the time of its inception in 1913, which has always led to demands from at least a few members of Congress for accountability. Congressman Wright Patman, in 1964, as chairman of the House Banking Committee, had Alfred Hayes, the very powerful president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, before his committee. Annoyed with the discussion of transparency, Patman told Hayes, "You can absolutely veto everything the president does. You have the power to veto what the Congress does, and the fact is that you have done it. You are going too far." I actually consider this an understatement, because in the past year or so, during this bailout process, the Federal Reserve has garnered an unbelievable amount of power, making it much more influential around the world than the Congress or the President has ever been. Patman accused the Fed of being too secretive, too independent, and the tool of Wall Street bankers. Though Patterson was right in his charges, his solutions did not demand a gold standard. He wanted Congress to assume the powers of money creation and interest rate controls, and his goal was to benefit the poor small business people and farmers. Populists then, as they always have and as they do today, want to restore the responsibility for money and credit to Congress. Though a laudable goal, it comes up short of providing a solution to the problems of steady depreciation of the money. Only gold can do that. Nevertheless, Patman, throughout his career, 1929 to 1976, continued to warn of the dangers of excessive Federal Reserve power and persistently demanded an audit of all its activities. Though I went into the Congress for the first time in April 1976, our paths did not cross. During his last year in Congress, his health was poor. But I did know and work closely with Henry Gonzalez on various issues, in particular, the IMF and other banking issues between 1979 and 1984. He was the chair of the Banking Committee, 1961 to 1999, and led the populist faction for nearly 30 years, demanding an audit and a curtailing of Fed power. A long time before Patman chaired of the Banking Committee, Congressman Lewis McFadden of Pennsylvania made the same attempts to alert the American people to the danger of excessive power residing in the hands of the few who control the Federal Reserve and the banking system. Although the populists of the past and present have not been hard money advocates, they always shared our conviction that transparency was crucial to any decent reforms. And today, Even though many liberal and conservative politicians join the populists' push for easy money and low interest rates, we can all join together in demanding that the secrecy of the Fed be ended. Reforms will follow, and then we will make the case for constitutional, sound money. I believe the conditions are more conducive today for achieving some real success in getting an audit than at any time since the establishment of the Federal Reserve System in 1913. When that time comes, I hope for some serious evaluation of the results in light of the Constitution.